You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 14 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. Today is Part 6 in our series on Richard Matheson, where we will be looking at his sixth book, Ride the Nightmare, as well as the Alfred Hitchcock Hour episode that it was adapted into, and the movie that it was adapted into, which is called Cold Sweat. Today we're joined once again by my Uncle Tony. How's it going, Uncle Tony?
Doing great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. You were with us for the West End Horror back when we were talking about Nicholas Meyer's books, and you're a librarian by trade.
That's what they call me. That's what my paycheck says.
Okay. So you're not familiar with Richard Matheson. This was your first
time I've read anything by him, and been exposed to his work. So.
All right, cool. Well, the reason why I asked you to be on this one is not so much because of the book, but because of the movie, which is Cold Sweat, which was directed by Terrence Young. Mm-hmm. And Terrence Young is the guy who directed the first two James Bond movies, Dr. No, and what I think is your favorite, or at least it was, From Russia with Love. Mm-hmm. And he also did Thunderball, but whatever. But we'll get into him later on.
All right.
You're a bit of a James Bond fan. The last time we talked about Sherlock Holmes, so this week
my two of my favorite literary characters.
All right, so Ride the Nightmare, it was a book which was written in 1959, which was the year after Matheson's last book, A Stir of Echoes, and it is about a guy who gets a phone call. He's married with a family in the suburbs or whatever in Los Angeles. He gets a phone call almost in the middle of the night from some guy saying that he wants to kill him. And, it is revealed over the course of the story that he was involved in a crime in his youth, and he's been hiding from it ever since. And now these people who he left hanging, he was the getaway driver and he drove away without them, are now looking for revenge. Uncle Tony, what did you think about Ride the Nightmare?
I have to say that it was probably one of the most exciting fictional stories I've read in quite some time. Grabbed my interest right from the start. Tight plot, well written, fast paced, a real thriller. I didn't find anything about it predictable. I thought it was a real attention grabber. I loved it. It was a great book.
What about you, Max? Had you read it before?
I don't think that I had read this before. I think I've read a couple of these novels before, but this one definitely did not strike me as familiar, although I did get a very sort of weird vibe on numerous occasions where I was like, this feels like an episode of 24.
I had the exact same reaction. Not so much an episode of 24 as like a season of 24.
Well, like particular points, mm-hmm. like where like I was like, that feels kind of odd and kind of like that didn't really need to happen. It kind of just happened because something had to happen at this point. And that is how I felt about 24. Pretty much every moment of 24 is, really? Is this still happening? The bad guys are doing something different now. And in this, I definitely had that sense on many occasions. I mean, like, it all still works, and it's certainly more intelligently handled than 24 handled things. But I did get that vibe many times.
I'm not sure. I think we've all either seen, maybe read other things, but definitely seen episodes where someone's running from their past and something gets unveiled and then there's a crisis involved. And so from that sense, the plot line wasn't unusual. Mm-hmm. But having said that, and thinking about when it was written in 1959...
It certainly seems ahead of its time.
Right. And certainly I can see this being the genesis for a lot that has come after.
Yeah.
Similar.
Yeah, I could say there was a lot of stuff in here which reminded me of something which came later on. Like, mm-hmm. I kept on thinking, like, and I guess with this, and there have been some other books, too, where I'm like, man, it would not surprise me at all if Quentin Tarantino was a huge Richard Matheson fan. Like the whole thing where you know, towards the end of the book, one of the bad guys gets shot, mm-hmm. and he basically is having a standoff with his, you know, his
accomplice,
yeah. Trying to convince him to take him to a doctor, whereas the other guy doesn't, and you know, there's a whole big thing about that, and that felt very, very similar to Reservoir Dogs in a lot of ways. But yeah, like with the 24 thing, I think like the impression that I got from it is like each chapter kind of ended on a cliffhanger, you know? It looked like things were being resolved, and then there would be a new complicating factor, which was even, you know, more intense than what had come before. You know, as I was reading it, I was like, this is a really simple story, you know, like I admired it from a, you know, kind of a technical level, I guess, and I was definitely riveted and entertained by the story, but the whole time I was kind of thinking, like, where is he going with this? What's the point? What's the message? Mm-hmm. And then at the end, I think he kind of hits the nail on the head. And, you know, it really is sort of an interesting look at good and evil, you know,
right.
from like a philosophical level, and how, you know, just because someone did something terrible, mm-hmm. that doesn't necessarily mean that they're a terrible person.
Right.
Things like that.
I actually would argue that the exact opposite is the point. That it's not that just because someone does something terrible that they're a terrible person. I think the opposite is true. I think the implication is that there is a terrible component in everyone.
Okay.
And that, like, life is actually pretty awful and dark. And realizing that, coming to terms with that reality, is a pretty awful thing that must happen to people at some point.
Okay, it's a little darker take on it, but I could see that too.
Yeah. I think the other thing too that, you know, is a whole idea that we don't live our lives in episodes.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the story kind of drives home the point that, or kind of the summation of everything that we've done and everything that's gone before, and
yeah,
it's very hard to run from your past. People mm-hmm. can change. But at times, you know, it catches up to you a little bit. So
yeah.
Well, there's an interesting moment where the protagonist's wife like realizes that whoever she was mm-hmm. is dead,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's part of the DNA of it. It's like she's a sort of a representative of a continuum of an identity, and it's not a given like structure. It's the entirety of it, and the guy who she was with. Like, she didn't really know his narrative, and now she knows it, but she doesn't know if she's still married to that person, because she might have died in the process of realizing that. It's a very bizarre sort of logical thing, but it's sort of like, life's too messy to have simple narratives.
You know, the idea of a person being the sum of all their experiences and all their collective experience, you know, that was really kind of a deeper, I think, theme on the whole,
yeah,
behind the exciting story that took place.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
There were times where like the plot felt kind of contrived,
mm-hmm.
but I sort of went, well, there's a reason for these things to happen, and it's not because the action has to keep going. And that's why I forgave it some plot contrivances that I thought were a little weak.
Well, 3 years later, the Alfred Hitchcock Hour adapted it into an episode, which Richard Matheson actually wrote himself, and it starred Jenna Rollins. Now, I watched it, and Max, you watched it too?
Yes.
What did you think about it?
I think this story is... it doesn't really work outside of the novel. Without the depth that the prose gives the characters, it really is just 24. It becomes just some guys called this guy, and it turns out that he like was involved in this thing a long time ago, and then like there's bad stuff happening. And without that, without the depth, without that internal life, it's just a bunch of stuff that happened.
Okay.
And it's and to me it's very very empty. And I don't like I tried to like, you know, like see the character the way I saw the character in the book, but I don't see the character in the Alfred Hitchcock episode as being like a complete person. I see him as being, you know, a protagonist established in 30 seconds so that that the audience can relate to him, but I don't relate to him. He mm-hmm. seems empty, like a like an automaton to me.
I did like it, but not nearly as much as the book. It's really interesting, like, at the beginning, like, maybe the first half is very, very faithful to the source material. It's almost word for word the same in some cases, but they, as the story, you know, goes along, it seems like as the further they get along, the more they remove. They don't really change anything. They just take stuff out. Like, there is no daughter in it.
Okay.
And a lot of the sort of like going back and forth, like getting the doctor and getting the money and all this, these things are kind of compressed into like one
mm-hmm.
event. And
has there been an adaptation of a Richard Matheson story that didn't remove the kids from the story?
Well, the movie, 'cause
has it, like, all of them so far I think have removed the kids except for Stir of Echoes.
Incredible Shrinking Woman.
Oh.
Yeah.
But that's not the same thing, though.
And Cold Sweat also has him has a kid in it. But yeah, here, this is, it's definitely the kid is gone. And I can kind of see that. But, you know, like you were saying, Max, it does lose a lot of the overall themes and stuff like that. The characters aren't nearly as rich. And it just because becomes sort of a suspense story. It's weird. It's not really what I think of when I think of, like, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. It's more of, like, an action thing. I mean, I guess it would be if, like, your average episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents is, you know, Psycho, this would be the North by Northwest of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, you know?
I'm not sure if that metaphor is labored enough.
Okay.
I think, you know, one of the axioms we usually encounter at the library is whenever there's a movie that comes out and it's based on a novel or,
yeah,
you know, written story of some type, 99 9/10 percent of the time the comment will be, well, I like the book better than the movie. And there's such radically different formats.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that it's almost like comparing apples and oranges.
Yeah.
When you're sitting down and you're reading a novel, you know, it's a much more intimate experience, I think. And
I think the inverse is true also. I think that novel adaptations of movies are invariably much worse than the movie.
Oh, yes.
When you transform a thing that belongs in one medium into a different medium, right, you have to break it in some fundamental way. Things are supposed to be what they're supposed to be. They're not supposed to be that and a different thing.
Right. I would agree with that statement wholeheartedly. It's two completely different art forms, and each one can stand on its own and be enjoyed on its own. But really, a book or a novella in this case has such an advantage in the sense that the character development can be played out to a greater extent than what a filmmaker has. So
it's interesting seeing, like, because there's a lot of movies which Matheson personally adapted into, you know, from his books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you see there, or what I've been seeing anyway, is that while the general story, the basic story,
mm-hmm.
is intact and much more true to the source material than most adaptations, what's missing is the thing that made that original material so great. And I mean, I don't know how much, I mean, well, I guess we have seen, you know, a few things that he has written directly for the screen, his episode of Star Trek, for one, Enemy Within, and those tend to be better than his adaptations. And I think it's because he's mm-hmm. playing to the medium instead of just trying to take past successes and translate them.
Yeah, that's a tough thing for a writer, director, I would think. You know, it's, you're trying to squeeze that round block into a square hole in it.
And the best adaptations are probably the ones that do depart rather radically from the source material and become their own thing. So moving on to the movie, which came out 8 years after the Alfred Hitchcock episode and 11 years after the book was written, Cold Sweat was directed by Terrence Young, who had directed Dr. No and From Russia with Love, as well as Thunderball and a bunch of other movies. It starred Charles Bronson, and it was written by a number of people, one of which was Shimon Winselberg, who Star Trek fans might know better as S-Bar David, the writer of Dagger of the Mind and the Galileo 7. Now, Max, you didn't see the movie?
No.
But you did, Uncle Tony.
I did. After having read the novella, it just, the movie, in my humble opinion, was really more of a vehicle for Charles Bronson. And the movie really did not have any sense to me of the anxiety and crisis that the protagonist was going through. I mean, the Matheson in the novella is so able to grab the reader, and you're into it, and your heart is pounding just like his is, and he's, you know, on the edge of disaster all the time. I never quite got that sense from the Bronson movie. Different settings, yeah. Southern France versus...
Right, we should note that this movie took some liberties with the book. It opened up the story a lot more, where, you know, the book was Los Angeles, you know, a family man who committed essentially a petty crime that went wrong earlier in his life. This is about a guy who, an American, who has moved to France in order to sort of run away from his past as a soldier in Korea, I think,
right,
who was thrown into the what would they be?
Like a
prison,
a brig situation. Brig, yeah.
For, you know, being, you know, drunk and disorderly and broke out, and in the process of breaking out for this, you know, petty offense, you know, someone again gets killed, a German police officer, right, gets killed.
Oh, a German police officer.
Yeah.
Right. The movie wasn't nearly as dark as the novella, and that may be a product of cinema versus written word again, but...
I like the idea of the Charles Bronson movie. It's a toned-down version of the story.
Well, and that, to me, that was very... yes, that is an ironic...
Yeah.
Cold Sweat to me was the title didn't really fit the
film. No.
It never elicited a nervous sweat moment from me.
Yeah,
room temperature sweat.
Actually, no sweat at all. It was you know, the interplay, the relationship between the character and his wife wasn't there, and that was such an integral part of the you know, in the book, Matheson is, you know, she goes through this metamorphosis too, you know, where, and you never really get that, that just isn't present in Cold Sweat.
Well, I mean, that was one of the things, I think, and that's one of the things which sort of, you know, breaks this movie, which, you know, I agree with you, is not very good. It was very much, I think, designed to be a vehicle for Charles Bronson. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, you know, the thing with the wife, for example, you know, the book keeps on going back and forth between perspective. You know, half of it is told from the husband's perspective and half of it's told from the wife's perspective. Right. So you see both of their mm-hmm. journeys. And whereas with Cold Sweat, it's all about, you know, the husband. The same thing with the Hitchcock episode.
And introducing the whole element of the heroine aspect of it with the, I mean, it was just...
Yeah, they went out of their way to...
Yeah.
Heroin?
Well, yeah, they basically turned these guys into drug dealers. You know, they went out of their way.
Well,
I think
that makes kind of sense.
Like a lot of the changes that were made, I think, were made in order to make it clear that Charles Bronson is a good guy.
Right.
You know, I think the whole thing with making him, you know, an army guy who, you know, it was not someone who was committing a crime. It was basically
a
guy
up in
who
the
was
wrong.
Yeah. And then also, you know, making these guys who he's with, you know, even badder bad guys than the ones that in the book.
I will say though that the bad guys in the book, I thought were a lot more sinister.
Yeah, they were because they seemed just crazy. Yeah, they weren't
psychotic. Mm-hmm. And
in this one, they seemed to have like they wanted to have like a main villain. You know, right. like one. Right. You know, big antagonist, you know, and getting James Mason to play him, I think was also, you know, very calculated.
It helps when the audience feels that there's a resolution once the hero has killed the villain.
Yeah.
If the villain is just one of several people.
Mm-hmm. Although that's not what happens here because he doesn't kill the villain and then they add like a whole.
Charles Bronson doesn't kill a villain?
No, Charles Bronson.
What kind of movie is this?
He doesn't kill James Mason, but then there's like a whole added thing where, you know, the book ends, spoilers, whatever. The book ends with, you know, the guy who is shot dying and the other guy chasing, you know, the wife and the wife lighting grass on fire.
Yeah.
And the guy dies. He's lit on fire.
That was just a little. The reader had to make a little bit of a leap on that one because she sets the grass on fire, and what the heck does this guy do? Did he run into the fire? How did he?
The way that I read it was she was running across a field of grass, and then she got to the edge of the grass, lit the grass on fire. So he was in the middle of the field
and
of grass.
And he was caught inside the
and he couldn't get away.
Well, that made sense. The movie, the Cold Sweat movie, it was kind of hilarious with the way they used the fire aspect of the. They tried to bring that element in with Bronson, but doesn't he shoot a flare at the guy? Wasn't that the.
Well, that was later on, yeah. I mean, they do the fire thing in there, but then it continues. That doesn't take care of the problem. That doesn't stop the bad guy.
Right.
And there's a whole other, you know, climax where they're on a boat. Mm-hmm. And then he shoots a flare at him, and the flare lights the guy on fire, and then they throw him overboard, and that's
it's
it.
Like they were trying to find a way to get that fire in there, you know.
Right, yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Also, the problem that I had with it was it seemed overly complicated. It was a lot more, well, complicated than the book was. The book had a very straightforward story, you know, and no extra motivations or anything like that were unnecessary. This had so much stuff going on.
Right.
Like these guys were, you know, bringing in drugs and everything. And it's just like, why is all there were more of them. You know, there weren't just three guys. There was like a whole team and stuff.
It's interesting, you know, that you say that with all the added factors in Cold Sweat, in an ironic type of way, I thought that the book, even though the characters were more complex and more real, the story was much cleaner.
It was,
It was much more satisfying because it left you in a certain place. It didn't seem contrived. The movie was really working hard to get.
Yeah,
to get you to a certain point, and
it had so many things going on.
Right,
so many. I didn't even know.
There's a philosophical clarity to the heroes and the villains in the story. There's like the bad guys are bad guys because they've essentially accepted that role. Like they're content with murder, and being ruthless and terrible, and essentially that's really the villain. It's not any individual. It's that idea of like, I'm going to just cut that part of humanity out of myself. Right. And that's what they're sort of fighting against. And that's sort of the underlying threat to the protagonist and his wife. I mean, that the idea that maybe by engaging with these people, they're doing the same things to themselves. It's a very simple sort of mechanic, but the urge to make the villain's motivation more obvious is sort of paradoxical because their motivation is very, very simple. They want stuff, and it doesn't really matter like why they want it or how they originally got it. But like in the 70s, there was sort of this like terror that like drug dealers were the bad guys,
right?
And then in the 80s, and it still happens, I guess.
My first reaction to the book was, amongst other things, it could be classified as a kind of a classic revenge tale. Except the protagonist isn't seeking revenge. It's not, you know, John Wayne and the Searchers. It's the bad guy seeking
revenge
on a guy who's trying to be right. good.
Kind of like Cape Fear, but with a bunch of guys.
Yeah.
Max, any final thoughts on Ride the Nightmare?
In terms of things that Richard Matheson has written that are totally worth reading, this would never have popped into my mind as being fairly significant, because this period of Matheson's career, it's sort of before he did his really, really wild out there stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I probably wouldn't even thought of it had it not been adapted into a number of things. But it's interesting reading a story like this that predates so many things that we consider to be typical of a particular genre and like style of like storytelling. And it's like regularly in these things I'm like, wow, Richard Matheson was writing like 20 years ahead of everybody else. I don't quite know how that is possible.
Mm-hmm.
But he's way ahead of the curve on this whole thing.
Yeah
I you know, ashamed to admit it, but even from just a librarian standpoint, I just had never really been too much aware of, you know, I've heard of I Am Legend and all that, but I didn't know there was this whole other aspect to his career. And I have to say that I'm fairly impressed with the literary effort in this. I would definitely have no problem recommending this to someone who I know, you know, likes to read suspense or noir type of novels.
All right. Well, before we wrap this up, I think that we should also note Richard Matheson's next book, which was turned into a movie, his next book period, which was The Beardless Warriors, which was written a year later in 1960. We're not going to be covering this book in detail because the movie that it was adapted into, The Young Warriors, is not available anywhere, so we can't really do it justice.
It was a theatrical release?
Yeah, it came out in 1966. It was written by Matheson himself and directed by John Pizer, who is probably best known for directing The Bulk of Combat. And it starred, I want to say his name was James Drury from The Virginian.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, it's a story about, you know, a young American soldier or a group of young American soldiers in Germany during World War II. And it's heavily based on Matheson's own experiences as a soldier in World War II, like an 18-year-old. The book, I guess, from what I understand, was fairly critically acclaimed. And upon its publication, there were a number of people who were very interested in adapting it into a movie, the first of which was Richard Zanuck, who produced...
there's a name.
Yeah, I mean, everything. And he was going to do it, but then opted to do The Longest Day instead. So he said no. And then Fred Zinnemann, who directed Planet of the Apes... Well. Patton, you know, he wanted to do it, but he had a lot of other projects on his plate. But Matheson didn't want to wait. He wanted it to go forward right away, so he declined Zinnemann's offer and opted to give it to Universal, who did it very, very cheaply. Even though Matheson himself wrote it, I guess it's not at all like the book, because one of the things that the studio wanted to do was incorporate all of the footage from the combat scenes from To Hell and Back into this movie so that they wouldn't have to shoot. So basically...
That's brilliant.
That is really that's really going on the cheap. Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Right. And hiring, you know, Pizer to direct it, I think was also...
Now I want to see a whole bunch of movies that do that.
Well, there probably are a whole bunch of movies that do that, but... You know, hiring, you know, Pizer to direct it was probably also a rather cheap move. Hiring, you know, like I saw the poster and said, you know, starring James Drury.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it says like, you know, star of the Virginia, star of TV's The Virginian, you know? I mean, getting a TV director to direct it. I mean, they did shoot it in CinemaScope, and the aspect ratio at that point would have been 2.35 to 1.
Stop!
Anyway, that is, you know, all very, very cheap. And I think the finished product is considered to be not very good.
Follows,
yeah.
Right now. Mm-hmm.
So that's that. But just figured we should make note of it. All right, well, that pretty much wraps up Ride the Nightmare and this week's episode. Thanks for joining us again, Uncle Tony.
Oh, my pleasure. Just, I'm happy that you asked.
All right, and yeah.
Yeah, you're always a good guest.
And yeah, go support your local library. Right.
Thank you for that PSA.
Okay. Don't steal books from it.
Yeah.
As always, you can find us on Twitter at ComTrackStars or email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. Or you can check out our other show, Commentary Track Stars, over on CommentaryTrackStars.com. We're coming up on the end of that, so check that out. And you can also find us over on Trek.fm, along with this show. You can go to the forums, and we're there, and leave us a comment. If you listen to this show, and you've never left a comment or said anything to us, say something to us. Make us feel special. Make us feel like we're not doing this in a vacuum.
Your favorite sports team is terrible at sports.
There you go. Respond to that. All right. That's it for this week. We will be back next week with John from Words with Nerds to discuss Hell House.